Patriots have had?
Well, I think about what it was like 17 years ago to the day on Sunday, February 3rd. We were the largest underdogs in the history of the Super Bowl.
Taking on the St. Louis Rams.
We're taking on the exact same franchise. And, you know, no one gave us a chance, and it came through. So I never take it for granted. The good news is when you practice well, at least you're in a position that you have a good chance. And I think we've had a good week of practice. The guys are really serious. They know how unique this opportunity is. And after we went the first time in 96, I was thinking, it might never happen again in my lifetime, so we better take advantage and enjoy every moment of it.
Senator Elizabeth Warren apologized to the Cherokee Nation for taking that DNA test to prove she had some Native American ancestry. The DNA test done in October angered some tribal leaders and sparked plenty of political pushback against the Democratic senator at the time. Please remember, you can check us out online at usaradio.com. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Well, good afternoon, Hunterdon County. Actually, we can't complain about the weather. I know, people think it's cold. However, I just want to remind everybody that if you were in Green Bay, Wisconsin yesterday, it was 26 degrees below zero, and that wasn't wind chill. Wind chill, it was 51 degrees below zero, coldest ever. And you can imagine the problems, actually serious problems. So I know it's been a little bit chilly here, but let's talk about the weather. Today was actually warmer than it was yesterday. I think at my house in the morning it was zero yesterday, or actually minus one, and today it was about 14 degrees. So if I can get the weather up, I'll let you know what the predictions are, because obviously it's going to get warmer, not colder. So they are talking about hazardous weather conditions, but I think that's just because it's cold. So this afternoon, I don't know where you were, there was a slight chance of snow. I saw a few flurries, but not much. Tonight there should be some clouds and then decreasing cloudiness. By tomorrow it's mostly sunny, which is good. Always pleasant when it's sunny. And high, it's really going to be about 34 degrees, so it's truly warming up. By tomorrow night, it'll be partly cloudy, low of about 25 degrees. And then Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday, mostly sunny and a high of about 44 degrees. Of course, that's not the temperature in Atlanta, and I know that everybody down there is going to really enjoy nice weather for the Super Bowl. But for us, for those of you who work on the Monday after Super Bowl, not me, but for those of who do, it should be a balmy 50 degrees and mostly sunny. So that's really the good news going forward. It's not going to be that cold. And it's certainly not that cold compared to other parts of the country, mainly the Midwest. So what's happening in other areas? Well, let's talk a little bit about the law. I'm Pat Smits, and the program is the program It's the Law. And let me tell you a little bit about some of our sponsors, and then we'll be back and talk about what's happening in some of the cases in New Jersey.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Well, good afternoon again. Hope you're going to have a wonderful weekend. Whether or not you're football fans, there should be a lot of things going on this weekend. But mainly it is football, and for those of us who think only football, understand that this is big. Even though we may not like the teams who are playing, and I'm not going to talk about that on this program. But what else is happening as far as cases? And I've talked to you about decisions in New Jersey. In other words, I've mentioned a number of times the difference between a published and an unpublished decision. Basically, what that means for lawyers and for other litigants, if you happen to be looking at the outcome of cases, if it's a published case, it's precedential, meaning that if the appellate court rules on an issue and a trial judge has a case with the same issue, they have to follow the precedent. And of course, the Supreme Court of New Jersey takes cases in a couple different ways. One, after a case has been appealed, the person who loses can ask for the Supreme Court to take up the case. They ask the court to grant cert. Now, the Supreme Court takes only a few cases that they're asked to take each year. The other way that it is done, meaning going up to the Supreme Court, is if one of the appellate judges dissents. And that's rare, because what happens is our appellate courts really try to come up with a consensus. So it's rather unusual to have a dissent from the appellate division. And, of course, in the appellate division, sometimes the cases are heard by three judges and sometimes by two. I've learned that you really can't think if you're the appellant, you're going to lose if it's only two, or if you're the respondent, you're going to win if there's actually three judges. But in any event, it's either two or three judges. And sometimes, actually, the judges, if only two hear oral argument on the appeal, they'll ask counsel if the counsel will agree to add a third judge or allow them to add a third judge when they write the opinion. Now, as I said, an unpublished case means that it is not precedent setting. However, I'm sure fellow attorneys would agree with me that many times the unpublished cases are very helpful, and frankly, many of us think that more cases should be published. I, you know, there's a question of why one case is published and another is not. Usually if the facts are so specific, that's one of the reasons where they feel that the factual situation is so specific and the decision is so specific to those facts that it won't have general application. So what's happening this week? There have not been many cases actually this week approved for publication. And again, that, you know, just happens to be the luck of the draw this week. However, the case that I did want to talk to you about, and I think this was an interesting case, it is approved for publication, and it was the State of Roman versus the City of Newark. And this is a Third Circuit case, meaning a federal case. And in this case, the plaintiff appealed from the dismissal of his 1983 claims. And what does that mean? Well, a Newark police, and I think it was more than one officer, but in any event, Newark police entered and searched the plaintiff's girlfriend's apartment. And they arrested the plaintiff after they found drugs in a common area. And after the plaintiff was indicted and detained for over 6 months, the state trial judge found the search unlawful. And so the trial court said, this is an unlawful search, and they dropped the charges. So then plaintiff was entitled to file a 1983 case alleging that the city had a pattern or practice, of constitutional violations, and the city failed to train and supervise its police officers. Plaintiff further alleged that due to the unlawful search of his girlfriend's apartment, the defendants were liable for his false imprisonment and malicious prosecution. So that was the basis for this. And the district court, meaning the federal district court, dismissed plaintiff's complaint in its entirety. So the federal district court, and the reason it was in the federal court is because the city of Newark was the defendant. So they ruled, the district court that is, that it was inadequately pled. And the district court further concluded that the city of Newark did not have an ongoing practice of unconstitutional searches or arrests. So that was very significant, that they found that the city did not have an ongoing practice of unconstitutional searches or arrests. So then on appeal, meaning the appeal goes from the district court to the Third Circuit, the court reversed in part the dismissal of plaintiff's complaint. And the Third Circuit held that the plaintiff had adequately alleged that the city's police department had a custom of warrantless searches and false arrests, and that the city failed to train and supervise its officers with respect to the Fourth Amendment and related law. The Third Circuit also noted that the plaintiff had presented a prior consent decree which demonstrated that at the time of plaintiff's arrest, there was a widespread practice of constitutional violations and searches and arrests. So there was an agreement, an acknowledgement by the city that had been going on. So that was important and significant. And also that the city failed to respond to citizen complaints about such practices. So when these violations went on, and people reported them to the city failed to do anything. So, again, that was very important. The court also pointed to the head of the police union's testimony that the last training he received was when he first joined the police force. So that, again, indicated that officers were not regularly trained on Fourth Amendment law. In other words, what they had to do, when they had to get arrest warrants, what could be seized, etc. And so in a concurring opinion, Judge Jordan agreed that the consent decree, meaning that the consent decree that the city signed and the plaintiff's amended complaint were sufficient to overcome dismissal in a concurring and dissenting opinion. Judge Hardiman argued that the majority erroneously relied on facts not pled in plaintiff's complaint to partially reverse the dismissal. So that is a case from the Third Circuit, and it was, in fact, presidential. Excuse me, not presidential. Precedential. In other words, it was precedent. Sorry for that flub. There is another case, again, that was approved for publication this week, decided on, the first one was decided yesterday, the civil rights case, State of Roman versus the City of Newark. So apparently, and I have not read the full case, apparently since it was the Estate of Roman suing Mr. Roman, and I believe it was a man, it doesn't have to be. It was search plaintiff's girlfriend's house. Obviously, girlfriend could have been another woman, but I think in this case it was not. And by the time of this case, by the time it wound its way up to the Third Circuit, he was dead, and so that was his estate that was named as a plaintiff. Actually, there was another federal district court in New Jersey that ruled that the named insured versus name insured exclusion in an insurance policy did not bar coverage after an employee of a named insured died and a lawsuit against the named insured was filed by his estate, so, and the widow. So that, a little different, but that is the situation where someone who dies, their estate can continue this. As I said, there's the labor law case, Bedoya versus American Eagle Express, Inc. And again, this was a Third Circuit case, written by Judge Schwartz. And in that case, the defendant appealed from the denial of its motion for judgment on the pleadings. And the plaintiff delivery drivers, the plaintiffs were delivery drivers for the defendant and alleged that the defendant misclassified them as independent contractors. So this is an important case, not just this case, but anyone who's hiring employees and call them independent contractors rather than employees. So this, any employer who decides to hire someone as an independent contractor have to be very careful if they're not really an employee. And, of course, employers want to do that because it saves them, from paying Social Security taxes, and it may, save them in other ways depending on how they handle independent contractors versus employees. So what happened in this case? Well, the delivery drivers for the defendant alleged that the defendant misclassified them as independent contractors when they qualified as employees under the New Jersey wage and hour law and the New Jersey wage and payment law. So this is very important. So the defendant had moved for judgment on the pleadings, arguing that the plaintiff's claims were preempted by the Federal Aviation Authorization Administration Act for 1994. The district court rejected that argument and denied its motion, ruling that there is no clear indication that Congress intended for the FAAAA to preempt state wage laws, and that the connection between defendant's workforce and the prices defendant charged to its customers was too attenuated to justify preemption. So the district court then certified the action for interlocutory appeal. And that's important because you can't just as right, you don't have a right in the middle of a case to appeal as of right. There has to be a permission, and in the federal district court, they certified the action for interlocutory appeal. In the state courts, an interlocutory appeal is handled by a motion, and it because it can't be an appeal of right, because the only time you can appeal as of right in New Jersey, well, the time to appeal is after all issues are resolved. So you cannot file an appeal without leave of court, meaning leave of the appellate division, just because you don't like a ruling while the case is still pending and ongoing. So you need approval from the appellate court in that case. So when it's filed, it's a motion for leave to appeal. So that's an important distinction, because as listeners have heard me say before, once a case is over, then either party has a right to appeal. So if it's not a final decision, then the appellate court has to decide, and usually they refuse. Sometimes if it's something that will be irreparably harmed, if you don't get the appellate court to look at it, they will grant the leave to appeal. But as I said, it's not usual, because what they usually say is, well, the judge will make a final decision, and the judge can change the decision, therefore we're not going to disturb it at this juncture. And family law, for example, a huge problem can occur if someone is ordered to pay, for example, too much support or not enough support. And because it can be, depending on which county, it can be a year, 2 years, or longer before the issue ever gets to court. And it doesn't help someone who, for example, needs to pay a mortgage and thinks that he or she is getting a certain amount per month and then doesn't get it. So that's just one example. So in this case, the court first held that the FAAAA expressly intended to have some preemptive effect, overcoming the presumption against federal preemption. But the court noted that the FAAAA only preempted state laws that had a significant effect on a motor carrier's prices, routes, or services, measured by the binding effect on the carrier to provide or not provide a price, route, or service, the various avenues for compliance, and whether the law created a patchwork of regulations. As applied to the NJWHL and the NJWPL, the court ruled that the FAAAA did not preempt New Jersey's ABC classifications test, and that was because it did not have a significant effect on prices, routes, or services. The court found that the test did not bind the defendant to a particular measure and method of providing the services. Nor would hiring employees conclusively increase the price charged to defendants' customers. The court also noted that the New Jersey classification test was similar to many other states' tests, and thus removing the threat of a patchwork of regulation. Well, let's bring you a couple spots from some of our sponsors, and then we'll be back and talk a little bit about some of the cases that were decided. As I said, the this one is important because anyone who is trying to decide whether or not they can hire a consultant and call an employee a consultant, this is really a significant area that employees need to check out carefully. I'm looking for my sponsor sheet. Sorry. Either we don't have it up to date, or I think I found it. We have two of them. Okay.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Rab Coins of Flemington, New Jersey has been in business for over 40 years. We are highly competitive buyers of gold, silver, and platinum coins, jewelry, and scrap metals, and have recently been named the exclusive gold buyer for Diamond Nation and HealthQuest. We also provide professional appraisals, sales and liquidation services for individuals, law firms, estate trustees, and bank trust departments in New Jersey and Philadelphia. Products and services include gold and silver, American and foreign coins, certified rare date and modern coins, numismatic supplies and books, gold, silver, and platinum bullion, paper currency, United States proof and mint sets, including current issues. From junior collector to the experienced investor, Rabcoin has been for the industry since 1974. Founder and owner Randy Block has been an expert and an active member of the coin industry for over 45 years. Visit us at 56 Main Street in historic downtown Flemington or call toll-free 1-800-819-9875.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business. One business at a time.
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Well, good afternoon again. It's the law, and we're talking about some of the cases that have been decided by the various courts, including the Federal District Court, and then went up to appeal to the Third Circuit. So we have, as we all or should know, in New Jersey, we have, of course, a state courts, a variety of courts that initially hear matters, including workman's comp and the regular trial court with different areas. And then there is an appellate division here in New Jersey, and every final judgment from the trial court isn't anybody who's dissatisfied is entitled to file an appeal. And then, of course, we have the New Jersey Supreme Court. We also, in New Jersey, of course, have the federal court, meaning the federal district court, and then the Third Circuit. And New Jersey is one of the states that the Third Circuit handles the appeals from. Now, actually, in other states, there are more courts. For example, at one time many years ago, I worked on the Navajo Reservation, and there was also tribal court. So that was a very interesting because depending on the case, the attorneys could decide whether or not to bring it in tribal court or in state court or in federal court. And, of course, there were many, many more cases that had to be brought in federal court because of the fact that we were working on a reservation and there were a number of things that state courts did not have jurisdiction over. That was out in Arizona and New Mexico. But here we don't have any tribal courts in New Jersey. So there was this case, New Jersey Manufacturers Insurance Company versus Specialty Surgical Center of New Brunswick. And in that case, the surgical center appealed from the trial court's decision vacating an arbitration award in their favor. In each case, the persons were insured by the plaintiff, New Jersey Manufacturers, and they suffered injuries in automobile accidents, and they underwent surgery at the Specialty Center, actually it was Specialty Surgical Center of New Brunswick. And each insured's surgical provider sought reimbursement under their patient's PIP coverage, meaning it's personal injury coverage when someone is in an accident. And so in each of those cases, they wanted the coverage, and they applied to New Jersey Manufacturers to get paid, basically. Now, New Jersey Manufacturers denied coverage, concluding that the procedures were not medically necessary or had no reimbursement on the fee schedule. So that was the issue. The insurance company said, hey, these procedures were not medically necessary. Or they, on other ones, they could have said, well, there's no reimbursement on the fee schedule. In this case, the parties proceeded to arbitration. There was arbitration clauses in their agreements, and that's what they had to do. And that arbitration in those cases resulted in awards against the insurance company in each case. So in other words, Specialty Surgical was, or I should say, New Jersey Manufacturers was ordered to pay in each of these cases. So what happened then is the New Jersey Manufacturers then filed the present actions seeking to vacate each award on the grounds that they resulted, and this is a quote, resulted from an erroneous and prejudicial application of the law to the facts. Interesting, that was their basis for their appeal. Now what happened, of course, is the trial court vacated each award and ruled the defendants would receive no reimbursement for the surgery. So at that point then, the defendants appealed, and the this case on appeal, the court affirmed the trial court's decision. And the court ruled that the appellate review of the matter was necessary to address the arbitration and the trial court's inconsistent interpretation of the relevant regulations. So interestingly, because the arbitrator ruled one way, the trial court ruled another, that's why the appellate division said, hey, we have to take this up and look at it because these are inconsistent. And because it was the arbitrations and the trial court decisions, they each had an interpretation that was inconsistent with the other, and they were inconsistent with respect to the relevant regulations. I guess that means that either side was very litigious or the regulations were not well articulated. So defendants contended that the plain language of the statutes required insurance companies to reimburse surgical centers for procedures under CPT codes approved by CMS. In contrast with what the plaintiff argued, and the plaintiff argued that another regulation prohibited payment for CPT codes if they were not listed in the fee schedule. So the appellate court ruled that the history of the fee schedule indicates that the department did not intend for surgical centers to receive reimbursement for the code procedures performed for plaintiffs' insurers. So that was one of the things they ruled. They just said, no, that was not something they expected a surgical center to do. So the court therefore ruled that the defendants could not receive reimbursement because no reimbursement was listed for the surgical centers. And there is more to this because they also said a clear indication of the department's intent not to reimburse surgical centers for procedural code. And this was consistent. The court further ruled that it was not relevant that Medicare now includes the CPT codes. So, and the reason for that is since it was the department rather than Medicare that amended the effective fee schedule. So that didn't make any difference. So what that means, of course, is that not only should the surgical centers, but everyone else who's going to provide care for anyone and who thinks that they're going to be reimbursed, by insurance, needs to double check that before they go ahead and, you know, spend a lot of money doing whatever they think they're going to be reimbursed and then find out later that it's not part of any policy, even though the person might have a policy. So that's a pretty significant situation. So there's also, and kind of near and dear to my heart in some ways because I lived in Hopewell Township, but there was a tax case, Verizon New Jersey Inc. versus the borough of Hopewell. And Hopewell has a tiny borough, and then it's surrounded by this huge township. There's a borough school, a Hopewell school, but children not only from the borough attend that school, but also from the surrounding township that's close. There is one high school for Hopewell Township and Hopewell Borough and Pennington. Pennington is also included. Pennington is part of that sending district. I shouldn't say sending district, but part of that district, both high school and the junior high. So this case is a tax case from, and it's from a tax, the tax court. And again, as I said, was decided this week. And in this case, the plaintiff Verizon filed suit challenging whether, pursuant to a prior decision, it should be subject to a statutorily imposed tax on its business property located in Hopewell Borough. The court's access, and this was the court's access to 51% of the Hopewell telephone exchange in this case. And that's why this is a little confusing. Let me try that again, and I do apologize. In this case, as I said, it was Verizon versus the borough of Hopewell, and it had to do with business property located in Hopewell Borough. And apparently there was a prior judgment that ruled the plaintiff should be subject to taxation if it provided dial tone and access to 51% of the Hopewell Telephone Exchange. The court also directed that the 51% test was to be performed annually by the assessment date of January 1st of the preceding year. Now, the parties disputed how to define the Hopewell Township Exchange and how to calculate market share within the exchange. So that's what that came down to. The exchange, well, let me go on. So the plaintiff provided testimony from two telecommunications experts, one of whom used NPA slash or dash N-O, excuse me, NXX and 911 data to conclude that the plaintiff provided less than 51% of the dial tone and access to the building in question. That expert opined that 911 data is reliable because the standards required to The standards required accurate record keeping, and the plaintiff's 911 data had been accepted in prior regulatory credentials. So plaintiff's second expert arrived at his conclusion using his company's proprietary methodology, which was developed using publicly available government data and other reputable data. So the court ultimately concluded with all of this that the borough's expert definition of a local telephone exchange was persuasive. In other words, they said, yep, your expert is the one we believe. And that's all, that is very important in cases that revolve around expert testimony. So the plaintiff's own tariff maps apparently defined the boundaries of what it considered to be the Hopewell Telephone Exchange. So apparently the records of the telephone company also conformed to what the expert for the borough was saying. So accordingly, the court ruled that the definition of the exchange would be the parties, would be based on the geographical boundaries listed on the plaintiff's maps, and accordingly concluded, as the parties conceded, the plaintiff provided more than 51% of the dial tone and access within that exchange. So they conceded as much, and guess what? They're going to be taxed. And one wonders how much that actually cost to litigate. And that's one of the unfortunate things, as we're all reminded that it's very expensive to litigate. There was another tax case that was published this week, and it was also deals with constitutional law. And it was Momar O.R. versus the director of the Division of Taxation. In this case, the let's see what the significant part is, that the parties both moved, cross-moved for summary judgment on the plaintiff's action. And the plaintiff was seeking a refund of sales tax paid on the purchase of his vehicle. So the plaintiff, a resident of New Jersey, purchased his vehicle from a dealer in New Jersey. The purchase price was paid in full without financing, and the plaintiff did not file a certification of exemption from the sales tax. So the facts were the plaintiff had purchased the vehicle with the express intent of shipping it to a family member or friend in Nigeria. And the plaintiff, in fact, shipped the vehicle for storage at his residence until he obtained the certificate of title and the clearance from the U.S. Customs to ship the vehicle internationally. So this legitimately, this plaintiff purchased a vehicle in New Jersey, but intended to have the vehicle shipped to Nigeria and not used in New Jersey. Now, he needed that clearance from the U.S. Customs to ship the vehicle internationally. Now, that would also allow him to transport the vehicle to a port for shipping to Nigeria. So, you know, the car dealer obviously was not right next to the ship that was going to take this car to Nigeria. So then the plaintiff filed a claim for the refund of the sales tax. However, the director denied a refund because the vehicle had not been delivered to a shipyard for exporting by the dealer, but instead the plaintiff had taken possession of the vehicle and stored it at his residence. So the director of taxation in New Jersey said, hey, the only way that this would work is if the dealer directly took the car and made sure that it was shipped. The court in this case, this was Division of Taxation, the court construed plaintiff as raising the issue of the applicability of the import-export clause of the U.S. Constitution. I guess most of us don't ever think we're going to have go to law school and have to interpret that, but that's what the court said. And the court noted that plaintiff provided no legal support for his belief that export of the vehicle exempted the purchase from the sales tax in support of his motion for summary judgment. And the director noted the plaintiff did not present an exemption certificate to the dealer. So apparently what the director was saying is that if he wanted to get this exempt from sales tax, he needed to do it earlier and present that to the dealer, and that the vehicle achieved a taxable situs in New Jersey due to its storage at the plaintiff's residence. So, and even if it was stored there for some time pending export, it still was in New Jersey. The court concluded that, in this case, the court concluded that the purchase was a taxable event because the plaintiff was a resident of New Jersey, and the court ruled that the import-export clause was not applicable once it applied. It was not applicable since it applied to taxation by the United States and not taxation by the states. And also, it's not the states. Well, and take that back, because I think that's going to be confusing. The tax imposed in this case was not one on goods passing through New Jersey for export. And that's apparently, if something is passing through New Jersey for export, that's when it's exempt from tax. But in this case, the flaw was that the plaintiff purchased it. That probably wouldn't have been a problem, but instead of making sure that the dealer handled that next step, meaning getting it to the ship, making sure that it was, in fact, shipped to another country. That was what is it is very, very significant and continues to be. So, you know, you do have to wonder, though, as this case went all the way up to, you know, the tax court appeal and probably much more, and that's the problem so often, it's really not worth it. And that's a hard thing to understand, but some things are worth it perhaps on principle, but many, it's not going to be any kind of a financial gain. Now, interesting, there was a U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit rejected a litigant's bid to reopen his police civil rights lawsuit based on claims that he was disadvantaged by unilaterally, relying on the attorney, and then the attorney's untimely death. Shame, it was a very prominent litigator. So that, there are a couple others, but they're really, some of them are pretty esoteric. There's an employment benefits case, administrative law. Anybody interested can certainly contact me and we'll talk about that. Now, it was an interesting situation for attorneys and judges is that a Superior Court judge has been suspended without pay for 2 months over secret recordings she made in meetings with her colleagues and superiors. So there's probably much more to that story, and whether or not there's anything in writing as far as the judiciary recording, that may be the reason why. But there has to be something, and I'm not sure I see anything in the Code of Judicial Ethics that prevent that. But there may be, and I guess I should take another look. Since I'm not a judge, I've not been that concerned. It's like if a judge really violates ethical rules, it's pretty blatant and pretty, you know, don't need to look at the rule book to say that there's something wrong. You might then look at the Code of Judicial Conduct to double check, but in any event, this is not exactly that. There have been a couple of criminal law cases that are somewhat interesting, but again, they have not been published. There's a consumer protection. I don't think I mentioned this last week. Defendants appealed from the appellate division's reversal of a trial court's grant of defendant's motion for summary judgment. What does summary judgment, and why is that? It means that their party, when they enter summary judgment against the party, it means that there's no factual issues, that the judge can just decide, for example, that there's no basis in the lawsuit by just looking at the lawsuit. And very significant because it means that the person, whoever is filing the suit, if that's the way it goes, you know, doesn't get a chance to present their shot at a jury or in a jury trial. And you know, it's a very tough situation to prove and probably very, in my estimate, very unlikely that it happens. Certainly things can be irritating, but whether or not they rise to the level of, in this case, a situation where someone is seeking summary judgment. And this, of course, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. It was Justice LaVecchia who wrote the decision, and the court held that customization of the product did not render it ineligible to qualify as merchandise. And that's what the case came down, ultimately came down to, although it was very time-consuming to try to follow everything that went on between trial court, appellate division, and the other trial court. So that is, in fact, significant. And there was a number of cases that were really very interesting, although not published. But there is a constitutional law case, and I don't think I mentioned this last week. I'm pretty sure that I didn't. Isn't it awful? We get to the point where we don't remember what we talk about from one week to the next. So I may have, and it is a very interesting case, though, as far as anyone who, this is a criminal law case and also constitutional law. So in this case, and I believe I did talk about it because it was the appellants, the people appealing, were convicted of sex offenses monitored by the state parole board and subject to that one is not going to hit the radar with any great speed, so it's not going there. Some of the unpublished cases I think are more important. However, if you're in the process of suing someone, this is meaning suing an attorney or doing anything that will, in fact, reflect on the defendant or defendant's counsel, you should stop and read these cases. There was a family law case that was published, and of course that's always something that I read, and I'll not have time to share with you because we're going to play the news and go on with the next program, which is going to be the sports guy. So let me play a few more things as far as spots from our commercials, and we'll get to the news.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi and Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi and Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi and Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call
everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing 100 engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists.